So, okay, welcome everybody. I want to talk about I.O. Turing. I.O. Turing is a kernel interface. It's comparatively new. It was merged in 2019. And as the name suggests, it has to do with input-output I.O. And it's a little bit of a new approach to I.O., at least for the Linux world. So that's a topic that gets us into system programming. I'm not a kernel programmer myself, but rather a general programmer, and I had to look into that topic and learn a lot for my open source project and want to share my insights, my experiences from that, and I will show you quite some code at the end, but I will explain everything. So it's not, you will be able to follow even if you don't get all the fine points of the code. So my name is Hermann Fossiller. I'm a professional software developer since 25 years. And before that, I had a phase where I was in academia. In the last 20 years, I worked in the banking sector, in the finance sector, built high-performance applications for processing of stock exchange trades and settlement of this kind of stuff. And of course, I'm open source programmer. That's what I'm focusing on right now. It's open source project. I've engaged in an open source project that's called Lumiera. It's quite an old, long-standing project and far from being complete. And there's always a lot of hard nuts to crack in that project. So one of them was to learn about a new kernel interface and use that for loading videos. So Lumiera is software for edit videos. So we have various media, video files, audio files, maybe MIDI, that kind of stuff. And we have them at files on the file system. We want to get them in because we want to arrange, mix, and combine those elements into a coherent mix. And we want then to play and render that, playback, immediately real-time playback, and render is the quality render at the end in high resolution. So you see there are various different goals. Sometimes you need real-time playback, sometimes you need a quality render. And as far as this talk is concerned, we have various design principles in the application, but I want to highlight one of that. We call it also guide fundamental forces. We strive in the application, in the design, we strive at the medium level of abstraction. Let's look into the Wikipedia. Abstraction in computer science is well defined. You know that probably. So it focuses attention on details of greater importance. And of course, you leave out some details in an abstraction. And what details you leave out depends on what you are about to do or what you're about to achieve with the abstraction. So each abstraction has a kind of framing. And so we might have a high-level abstraction, or we have a very low-level like nodes in the video editor. And we are going for the medium level. And this has a lot of consequences for the design of our application, but I will not expand on that. That would be another talk on itself. But it leads that we are placed into a somewhat challenging situation in our engine. Because we conclude from our principles that we use external libraries for the actual video and media processing and compute. So we have external calls that we need to organize, orchestrate. We need the buffers for them, we need to get the data into the system and out. And further on, we have those various workloads. At times we need real-time playback, at other times we need a quality render. So, and video in itself is challenging. It always pushes the line of the computing. So in the end, we are forced to make optimum use of resources. That's the goal that sets the direction of that talk. And once you realize that, you see there's one resource that is kind of problematic. compute is not problematic. We can quite well guess how fast it is. But I/O is problematic. I/O, as everyone knows, I/O is slow. Yes, it's very slow. But slow can mean several things. It can mean throughput. How much data can I compute in a unit of time? But it can also mean the latency. How quick can the system respond to changes? And these are conflicting goals. I cannot have an optimum in both of these directions. For example, if I want a quick response, a latency, then I have to sacrifice some throughput for it, so that the system is. And furthermore, I/O depends. It depends on a lot of things which can vary. There's no general rule, especially the workload, the access pattern. Alone in video itself, you could have raw video media files, which are huge. You could have compressed ones, or you could have a frame cache, where you have scattered reads and pick the stuff together from a solid state disk. So in the end, it's hard to predict. It's hard to predict how it will behave. And we got a further challenge, a recent one, a new twist, namely I/O is no longer slow. You probably know what I mean, what I'm headed about. It's the solid state disks. Since we have solid state disks, I/O has gotten nastily fast. It's still slow, and it brings me to the question what actually means fast and what means slow here in this context. So let's have a look at the time scales we are dealing with in the realm of computing. And as you know, these time scales will span several orders of magnitude, from the seconds down to the nanoseconds. A nanosecond is 1/1 billion. That's a load of fine-grained detail, and I wanted to put them here on a single slide. So I needed to use a logarithmic scale. Otherwise, it wouldn't fit. The second line would have a scale of 1,000 if I have a linear scale. So the logarithmic scale, but it's also quite natural. It's confusing if you see it, but it's quite natural for us humans, because we grasp times and time intervals in relation to each other, not in absolute terms. So let's start with the heartbeat. The heartbeat of the computer is the clock cycle. And the clock cycle is below 1 nanosecond. Typical values that you can read in sources are 1/3 of a nanosecond of a modern computer. It's quite fast. And then you see in the nanosecond scale, you see all these memory hierarchy, the level 1 to level 3 cache. And at 100 nanoseconds, we have the DRAM access, getting in the main memory. And even a little bit further, at 300 nanoseconds, about 3 times the speed for getting into the main memory is invoking the system. A system call is quite expensive, you know. There's a lot of machinery going on there. You have to switch the context, you have to elevate the privileges, you have to flush out several buffers, and it got worse due to the mitigations for Spectre and Meltdown that made those calls quite expensive. And that's the baseline. If you press it and do nothing in the kernel, you land by 300 nanoseconds. And a read that happens to hit the cache sits already at 1 microsecond. And so the microsecond scale, that is where we are in the operating system domain. We have those things like a context switch. We have the quite expensive wake up of a thread. And an interesting thing that OS timers lack. You know, modern operating systems do not work in fixed time slots anymore, but they do some kind of batching, so that they do not have to react all the time. They group together some of their activities. So if you do a targeted wait in the thread, if you make it sleep, you can define quite fine-grained target values, but you will land at some aggregated grid points, and that's about 50 microseconds. You can easily measure that. So you have a kind of uncertainty drin in this part. And if we go further into the millisecond range, then we have the well-known disk seek at about 10 milliseconds, and we have our goalpost for video processing, the cinema video, 25 frames per second. One frame of such a video, that is 30 milliseconds. So that's the time we have, that's the time that's available for compute or getting in the next frame for display. And interestingly, in the range of the milliseconds, it's also where we enter the range where human perception starts. A delay of 10 milliseconds is barely noticeable. And of course, the musicians can detect even slower latencies, especially the orchestra musicians or the keyboard players. They are quite sensitive for this kind of stuff. And on the other hand, 20 milliseconds is when you can perceive an echo. You can distinguish an echo from the original sound at starting at 20 milliseconds. And 40 milliseconds on our frame, you know, cinema film slightly flickers already. And if we go up to a tenth of a second, that's the point where an UI starts getting sluggish. It feels sluggish. It's no longer agile. And if we then go up into the 1 second area, it's where the computer start getting annoying. So, wow, it's thinking, oh, why is this taking so long? And at 3 minutes, I take yet another cup of coffee, and someone I'm pissed off and throw the box in the corner. So that's quite a huge amount of time scales, and still difficult to grasp. So we need to put it a little bit into perspective, but I don't want to annoy you with Olympic swimming pools or soccer fields. I'll do something different. Let's assume the computer is a human. Yeah, that's a nice pace. So that would be the clock cycle, 1 second. So what would that mean? It would mean that we take 5 minutes to get in the main memory. We need 1 hour to do a system call, and we are in the days to months to get to the I/O, and it takes us 4 years to compute a single frame. So that's quite impressive here. Usually we don't realize what powerful machines, what powerful systems we have here. Sitting at the desk, humming silently, or we take that for granted. Quite powerful. So I can get back to the middle time scale, and now I can show you what happened with the I/O. You see, that was the good old time. That was comfortably slow. And now it's nastily slow. It's nastily slow because we are landing in the operating system area. It's no longer really slower than the kind of latencies we have in the operating systems, and we are running danger to stomp on our own feet. If we want to react to the I/O, we running danger that our thread will go to sleep and we spend 30 microseconds for waking up and so on. It's not easy. So to summarize it, the I/O invades our control flow. Control flow, we have usually in the programs, we have nicely laid out logic. It's linear, it sometimes is forks, there are loops, everything deterministic. Now we have something that just happens. Just if you wait 6 months, suddenly comes an I/O. So that's the problem. It invades our control flow, and if you want to handle it, we create accidental overhead. So we have to look about for established patterns to deal with that. And one I want to mention first is not a defect. It's actually quite ingenious, namely that is to block while we do I/O. That was an innovation in the 70s. Where we came in the earlier times, we came from the mainframe computers, and there were the new Unix world, and slightly exaggerating things here. But the new idea is, I have a process, there is everything deterministic in there. I have my control flow in there. And everything that's not deterministic is taken care of by the kernel. I connect the pipes, the blocks with pipelines, and whenever a producer is too fast, a consumer is too slow, the producer is just hibernated and shock frozen, and all that nasty juggling is done by the kernel, and I as a developer doesn't even notice it. So that's not a fact, it's really an ingenious solution that worked for a long time very well, until the floor was pulled out below of us by those nastily slow solid-state disks. And then we have the other approaches that were developed since the 90s or so, the select and epoll style, especially for the network sockets. I can avoid the problems when I know that I do not touch the socket until I know it's actually ready and I can read, so I can circumvent the block. That was for a long time was the standard way to deal with it in the Unix and Linux. And then we have that other new idea that we say I/O is so difficult, I want to delegate it to a service. I have a service, someone should take care of that. I define a job. Get me this data from the disk. I define a job, I hand it over to a service, I put an API, and when it's done, I can reap the results. And that's the new idea. That was comparatively new for the Linux camp. The Windows NT had this for quite some time, so quite some longer time. They had a different approach to these topics. But now we have in Linux also an interface, that's the IO-URing I'm talking about, an interface that has such an instruction. I can create a job, hand it over to the kernel, get the work done, pick up the results. That's the new interface. And now I can explain you you understand better why it's the way and why it makes sense. And the interface itself has a quite small interface surface. It's very simple. You have just a pair of ring buffers. Now, what does ring buffer mean? I can explain that by a single expression in C or C++ language. This expression here, buffer, would be a pointer. That would be the pointer to the memory block, the allocation I have created. And I can apply the subscript operator to that. That's a special twist in C and C++. And that means that the subscript gets me increments in an element size. The buffer is defined in a type, and I get increments in an element size. So I can index and step into an array of memory. But I've put something interesting here, that's the modulus operator. That's the interesting point. You have a cursor, that's a growing positive value, and I take it modulus the ring size, so the division remainder, you know, the division remainder wraps. And that gives me, that clever trick gives me that I can use a block of memory in a circular fashion, and the slots circle around. Just with that little expression. That kind of compelling things, little marvels of low-level programming. So, and we have two such ring buffers, and we use them as queues. In one queue go the submissions, the task that we want to hand to the kernel, and in the other one, we get the completed tasks back. And incidentally, U-ring, you hear the ring buffer, and the U stands for user space, because it is memory mapped. We can access it from our process space. We do not have to switch over to the kernel. And it fits quite nicely into the typical paradigm of kernel invocations. We all know the proc file system or the sys file system, where it looks as if we have files, but actually we're looking into kernel data structures. And that's affected by memory mapping. And IO-URing works the same way. I open a file, a URing file from the kernel, and then I memory map it into my process space. And then in that file, I discover certain offsets. I discover pointers and offsets that describe that ring buffers. So it's a little bit technically to map up, but it's quite simple. And then I have another nice element. I attach a mark, a tag, or a sentinel value, or now a button. It's rather button, a Staffelstab of German. So I can tag and mark my calls, and I can control the value. The kernel doesn't care for what I put in. It's 64 bytes, so I could, for example, put a pointer in. I use a pointer, put the pointer, put my data structure somewhere, my buffers, and put a pointer to the buffer into the call. And when I get the call back from the completion queue, I find the pointer and just walk to my buffers and pick them up. It's quite intelligently done. But I can do every index value I can put in there. Yes, and the submissions indeed model classical system calls. They cover a lot of ground. All the classical I/O related things. I have now a unified interface for making I/O. Disk reads, scattered reads, but also seek or directory operations, stating a file, but also memory, binding a socket, accepting. And one unified interface for all this huge area of I/O activities. So, to summarize what we got a way to make syscalls without making syscalls. We can batch a whole bunch of these calls into our block, and then we do have to pay that overhead only a single time. There's even an extension where the kernel pulls, so that we get absolutely zero overhead. And the completions, we get them back into user space. We do not have a kernel invocation. So that's quite a deal for people doing high performance computing. So the big API servers, you can handle millions of calls, of networks calls and ANIs with the new systems. And in our case, with the video, it's also good because it fits nice into the scheduling. But there's a catch. It started a security night war because we can make syscalls without making syscalls. So every software that detects vulnerability is blind for this new attack surface. They just see one inertial syscall that maps a ring buffer. And everything one is below the radar. So this was quite a deep problem after it was merged. I hope most of it is sorted out now meanwhile. And then we have the libEuring on top. LibEuring is a thin abstraction layer. Everyone uses that because it alleviates the need to engage in that mapping. I can set up the Euring directly with a function. I get an AP call get my system AP calls back, but I don't call in the kernel anymore. Rather, they build data entries that I could put in the submission queue. And last but not least, I have those high-level functions so that I can peek into the completion queue or I can block on it and wake up when there are new submissions to handle. But I said it's a thin abstraction layer. It's again a medium-level abstraction. So you need to understand what's going on below the hood to make good. You need to both know that I have data items that I'm sending into queues, and you need to care for synchronization. That's a very important point, and I need to touch on that before I can show you code. Synchronization is a nasty topic, especially in the low-level context. It has two meanings. First and foremost, we want to correlate control flows. Of course, we want it. We want several threads. We want them to operate in lockstep. But we cannot achieve that directly, so we have to care first for the visibility. And that might sound a little bit surprising, visibility, why? Now, it has to do with the cache coherence. And it's based on the fact that our compute resource has gotten faster and faster. Moore's law is intact. we get every n years we get a doubled compute capacity. But the periphery, the connectivity, the wasn't able to keep up. So we went parallel. And that creates these coherency problems. We are now have now parallel architectures, and many people aren't even aware if you write code that runs on one core, it cannot even access the main memory. You know, it takes 5 minutes to connect to the main memory. So each core, if you have just the inertial variable x, actually we have several copies of that variable flying around, and if core, the left core, happens to update the variable to one, then the core B doesn't see it. Even after the fact, the core B reads this tail value zero. And that's not a defect. It's not a defect, it's the way it's assumed to be, because such local variables are simply not meant to be used below the boundaries of a thread without any precautions. And it gets even nastier when eventually, after some time, the cache is flushed, then the x equal one is written out in the memory, but this core doesn't get notified. It continues to operate on this tail value. So it seems near impossible to write any sensible algorithm with such a system where you cannot coordinate variables over that boundary. So we need help. We are fighting enemies here, and I'd say we have two enemies that we fight here. One is what I've explained to you, the cache effects, the non-uniform memory access. But there's another enemy, and he is sitting in our own team. It's our friend, the compiler. The compiler or the optimizer is allowed to shuffle around instructions. Some are very fast, sub nanoseconds, andere take tens of nanoseconds and more, and you can gain a lot of speed improvement by shuffling them around based on the local logic. That's only the only thing the compiler can see. So we need help, and it depends on so much on the hardware. We need an abstraction again from help from the programming languages or so. We have concepts or interfaces like the barriers or fences. They are quite old. I think the barriers were first popularized in the Java programming language in their memory model. Yeah, and designated in this way, store. So, for example, store load is the most expensive one, and it means I have a store beforehand, then I put in a fence, and then I have a load, and this construction gives me the guarantee that the effect of the store is really seen before the effect of the load. That's what I get here. And the other one, the memory order, is what we see in C and C++. We have special variables, the so-called atomics, and these are meant to be used beyond the bounds of a single thread. And here the memory order, they map in a slightly confusing way, the memory order relaxed, acquire, get me a value, release, publish something, and do everything sequentially consistent. They map in a slightly confusing way onto the operations, and I think it's good to have a look at an example. A textbook example of a producer and a consumer. So I have an atomic flag. I want to communicate with that flag. It goes to several states, and both the producer and the consumer can see it. This is basically pseudocode. You need to start the threads, but I show you just some snippets here of the relevant code of the producer and the consumer. So, and let's look at the producer. We have ordinary stores and loads. He does something, computes something, and then we put here the barrier. Here we do a store on the atomic variable, and we mark it as a release, a publish operation. So we get this kind of read barrier. It's to more precise, we have stores and loads before it, and then we have one store behind it. And it's symmetrically on the other side in the consumer. We have an atomic load here, And then we have loads and stores behind that. But note the twist. We need to check, we need to test if we see a change here. If we don't do that, it will be wrong, because if we don't see the change, we have no information. We don't know where we are in the synchronization game. Only if we detect the change, then we know that we see all the changes here, done here beforehand. We see it here below the other fence. And that's peculiar setup gives you the order which is known as synchronizes with. And that's the basic seed from which we build any other further primitives of synchronization. So I can wrap up about the architecture, but I will be skimming slightly over it. What we always need is state tracking, and you will see that in my example, because I/O is stateful, and yes, we have different ways. And I want to introduce the term back pressure. Back pressure means you model it as a pipe, and the producer pours something down, and he can flood the consumer. When the consumer cannot keep up, the consumer needs to push back through the pipe and say, hey, stop it. So that's it, and then we set up a processing framework. In the most simplest case, it's a polling thread, a manager thread, and here is the name for the game. We are polling completions, so it has been settled proactively, and that's why that pattern is called a proactor. We have a manager thread that reaps the completions that are coming back from the kernel. And that brings me at the point where we can start to looking at code or writing code and using that framework, to use that framework. And I tap back into the video topic here. I will write a little video player. The video player will write raw video files from huge files from the storage using I/O Turing, and I will read in per frame. I will have tasks to read a frame and get it in, and we will have a proactor thread to coordinate the use from the I/O Turing. Then we need to get it on the screen. And that's a topic in itself, quite an elaborate topic. It happened that Benny and myself did a talk last year here in the ForceCon, where we digged into that topic, how to get pixels, raw video pixels on screen, and how to use the OpenGL frameworks or other frameworks and use the GPU. And I will reuse the code that we have published on our website also as a black box. For us, it's a black box. There's OpenGL in somewhere involved, and we give it a buffer with raw video, and it magically appears on the screen. And that's it. So that's the general idea. And I use a GTK application as a shell, and this will open a window, and this window has a button, and when I click on that button, an event happens, because so? Genau, so, if we click on that button, there we have an event, and the event happens in the UI thread. It's the GUI runs in a thread, and the events are processed, but we are using another thread, the proactor, where the other stuff happens. So this event should create us a video player and package that as an object, so that I can define the member variables, which are set up and wired in a well-defined way. And I know when the object is created, a component has been built and wired in the right way, and I can use it. And what's important, they are all private. So only the object itself can use those. And here I use the dispatcher. I have to talk about that in a minute, because that's the mechanism how I get things over from the proactor thread into the UI thread. And I have the video display. I've highlighted that it's actually a type def. There is our OpenGL EGL display, and we have an instance and we wire it. So we have to look peek a little bit into that video display, into the constructor. The first thing we notice here is that I use hardwired dimensions as template arguments, because I do not want to pull in all that complexity of changing the resolution in mid-flight. That would be a lot of complexity and is besides the topic here. So I use hardwired elements, and then I put in an inner class that's an interface. It's abstract, and it mixes in the glib dispatcher. Glib is the base library of GTK, and the glib dispatcher, I can bind a function into it, and when it's invoked, it will trigger that function and run it in the UI event thread. So it's a nice mechanism. I can trigger it from anywhere and trigger an argument-less function, so that will be the impulse to show a frame. And then I've defined the API functions to retrieve the data and to signal the completion back from the display. And that's an interface, so that's everything the display needs to know to make effective use. And of course, I wire a subclass here, subclass instance, because someone needs to implement that interface, and that's obviously the player, the video player. And here we bind our display frame function, because that's what we want to run in the UI thread. Whenever a frame gets displayed, we want to run that display OpenGL operation. So we can return to the video player and fill in the missing parts. I have here the implementation. And furthermore, it's an inner class, and it can, like IET, it can phone home to the video player and use the internals, so that we can write an effective implementation, and they can communicate with the proactor thread, because the proactor thread sits in the video player. So here we create it, wire it, pass it to the video displayer, so that both sides can access the dispatcher. Then furthermore, we have the usual stuff. We allocate buffers. And that's the point. We have to open several slots. We make an U-ring. We have to decide how many slots we take for reading. That's a delicate question. If I use too many slots, I will fill up needlessly memory and I will read ahead way too much. If I use too few slots, then I will get frame glitches. So that's a balance to strike. In that implementation, I use the hardwired value of 5 slots, and then I allocate a storage buffer for the pixels and a further slot for the states that we have to track, then, because we have to track states for each buffer. And you see the buffer state enum here, and this pointer, this atomic pointer, is where we hinge the handover of the data between the two threads. So I've depicted it here. We have the GUI thread, we have the proactor thread, and whenever we know that a slot is ready, then we publish that pointer into that to display pointer. And then we trigger the dispatcher, and the other side can go over read barrier and get the pointer. And when the display hands it over to OpenGL, and when it's done, then it writes null back into the pointer. Recall that we always need a change to be sure. So it can write null back, and this is the way how we coordinate both threads to work together at that point. Yes, and here at the end, we have a thread object, and that's the proactor thread, and there's the play video function where we can start now to implement the core of our logic. Let's start with the boring part, the boilerplate. I open a file with the raw video. I allocate actually those buffers to the ring size, and then I open the IO U-ring connection. So simple lib U-ring makes it easy, but note the fine point. I used one additional slot here, because I want to have a timer. I want to use a kernel timer that triggers us whenever the next frame needs to be displayed. It might not be obvious, but our display runs maybe with 60 frames per second, 100 frames per second, I don't know. The video runs with 25 or 50 frames per second. These are numbers that don't mesh up. So we need a timer, and we approach it that way, that just when we have a new frame and the time is due, we hand it over, and the OpenGL part just cares to do the buffer flip for itself. And if we don't hand everything new over, then we don't need to redraw on the other side. So that's the point here. And here we configure the frame timer. This is also the first example where we use I/O Euring. I've written a little function that takes a chrono specification, 20 milliseconds, because I want to play 50 frames per second, and translate it in a kernel time spec. And then we get a new open slot of the ring. We need to notify that this is a slot. I want basically kind of have locked it. I will populate it with data so the kernel cannot stop on it with other stuff from behind. And this is the builder function. The builder function to create a timeout operation in the kernel. So I put the timer submission rein, the time spec, and a marker that it will run forever. And I attach the tag value. I've invented a sentinel value. I used uint max here as a sentinel value to mark whenever the timer fires, I can recognize that the tag value is in the user data. Here I put this user data. And in all other cases, I wouldn't put the frame number into that slot. So whenever I see the sentinel value, I know that I am dealing with the frame event. And then I fill the Euring with tasks and do a commit to the kernel and set the machinery into going. So let's have a quick look how we fill up this that ring for the first time. Let's recall the state definition. Each buffer slot goes from state free to read, free to showed, and so right, and so on. And I loop here while the buffer state is free. You see the cursor, the next read, the modulus, and so as long as the buffer is marked as free, I can fill in new slots. Then I read the source position in the media. I've used a lambda function that loops start frame and a loop. I want to play the video and loop. And I did that to show you the point that we have several cursors or independent positions. We have a read position, we have a next frame position, we have a to display position here. Then we open the next slot. We have already seen that. We use a builder function to instruct the read. Give it the buffer where the data should be sit, the offset in the source medium where we want to seek to. And we set the user data, and here we put the current cursor as frame number in so that we know which frame number that will be to display. And then that's the important point where we flip the toggle. We mark that, we advance that state from free to read. So it, and we can loop as long as we get free frames, as long as we find free slots, as long we can fill that up with new tasks. Then we can advance the cursor. So that's it here, and that gets us to the core of the whole story, the proactor loop itself, and it is built around a blocking wait. It's a service trait, and when there is no completion, it can go to sleep, because it doesn't matter. For video, it doesn't matter. For high-performance computing, it would matter, the nanoseconds, but for video, we have an event every 20 milliseconds, so we can go to sleep here. It depends on the use case, if we need to care for going to sleep or not. So here a proactor seems quite right. And again, we pick up the user data for the tag, and then we can see if we have to handle a tick or if we have a regular frame completed read. And after that, we mark to the kernel, I have seen that completion, you can override it and reuse it and recycle it. So, and also this handling of completed reads is very simple. It's just a state flip. So again, it's always the same pattern. We pick up the user data, so we know the frame number, we go with the frame number into the ring, we access the state, and then we do a quick check if we run hit out of end of file, or we toggle the state, so it goes to the feed. The next step is we need to feed it to the UI. So that's the maybe display frame, that's the most nasty and most involved function here in the whole code, because that's the point where we need to coordinate. For one, we need to hand over the buffer to the UI, but also we need to implement that back pressure so that the producer cannot overrun the consumer. And at that point, let's reconsider what we've picked up already while reading the code. We have a state engine here. We start with a free slot. We start with a free slot. We submit a read operation. We mark it as read. It's in flight now. The kernel owns it. If something goes wrong, we stop the player. But usually the kernel gets back with read completed. Then we know on the next opportunity, we need to feed it over to the buffer. And when this happens, when we know that the timer tick has triggered, we know then we go to the show state and wait for the UI side to set that pointer back to null. So that's the point where those threads are locked together and work together. And now let's look at the whole ring with 5 buffers here. You see each is in a different state. The slot 0, that's where our next show cursor, we have next show and the next read cursor, and this is where the coordination happens between those both. The slot 0 is already pushed over to the UI. The next one is ready, the data is has arrived from the kernel, but we wait for the next opportunity to show a frame. Then these two and three are in flight. They are owned by the kernel, and somehow will the data will arrive in those slots. And the last one is free and can be filled with the next tasks whenever we have an opportunity to fill up the data. And that's here. We do this always when we move that point over here. We can move that point over here. So it goes constantly in the circle. So let's have a look at the code. It's all hinged on the next show point cursor, and we have only a single point here marked in orange where the next show is incremented. And that happens only here at that point if we are in the show state, if that slot is in the show state and the null pointer was pushed back from the UI. So we knew the slot is free now, and then we can advance the next show. That's the very point where the UI can block, where the other side can block, the consumer can block. And in all other cases, we just use that variable in the typical way with the modulus operator to access the buffer state, the buffer data, whatever. So the cross thread handoff we have probably spotted is, we have a read barrier here. When we load the null pointer, we have a write barrier here. When we push over the next frame address. And we have the glib dispatcher where we trigger the display operation on the other side of the gap in the UI thread. And okay, that's the point I've already showed it. That's the point where we coordinate both threads. So the last point is to look a little bit in the OpenGL side. Here we see we get our pixels and put them into a texture, and that's the point where we don't look any further. But there's another fine point. We can get a null pointer back because of those pushback operations, and we just ignore that here. It's a demo. That makes our frames just slip. In a real world application, that would be where the real fun starts, because then you would run out of sync with the audio and you would have to do something more clever than letting the frame slip. So, but that's the point where you detect it. And furthermore, we use just the callback that's opaque here. The display doesn't need to know what's behind it, but we can look in the code and we can see, yes, there's again a load, and here is again, when we publish back the null pointer, here's again an atomic store. And that's it. The interesting observation is there was not a single piece of code where we could see the control flow written down in closed logic anywhere. We are really doing here message-driven programming. We react on state transitions. We met pattern match, kind of pattern match, on state transitions. And we just look at the local conditions when we can do that. And if our reasoning is sound, the whole machinery will work properly. And we should look at it if it actually does work properly. Hope everything works out fine. Here we have the source code. The demo using CPP is the core. And then I build it. So we have a new executable of 1549, and that's what we invoke now. And here we get a tiny little GTK window. It has nicely written IO URing in the header, and there's a button to click to start video, and if I click there, everything will explode. I've built in a little bit of time observation and at the side. It's a moving average, and you can see it's a solid state disk, but it's not the fastest one. It's in the single low digit milliseconds what we have at read times. And when I do here some IO operation, you see I get slipped frames. But the load is not dramatic. Most of the CPU load that I see is from Firefox. It was there already. So the CPUs are idling mostly. You see the Firefox is working, not our program. So you see it works. Our machinery works and get the files. We have 50 frames per second here, 1,200 pixels. And those 20 seconds in this loop are about 20 gigabytes of file on the storage.
I don't think you realize it, but that notebook is probably older than Frostpunk. Think about it.
No, it's not older than. Yeah. Okay, so that was it. I just wrap up with a little consideration regarding Lumiere and the application. That's pull versus push. Here we did push. The ProActor is basically a push application. It acts, there is an event from the kernel, and it has to act on it. And usually, if you do more than just publish something into OpenGL, you would have to dispatch it to a worker. For a more complicated workload, maybe the ProActor is not the best fit. And in Lumiere, we're going full into the pull direction. So there, ProActor would not be the best solution, but IO URing is a good fit. Because we can integrate it in our framework with active workers. They go to the scheduler, they look into the IO URing, peek into the IO URing. If there are IO work to do, they do that. Otherwise, they go and do compute. So it fits in very nicely. And that was it. I have put a QR code. You can look at the example code here, and if you hit any problems, I had to do a tweak here, but I think it was the GPU hardware here. If you hit any problems, then mail me or ask me. And of course, if you have questions, you can ask me. Here we have some minutes for questions. So that was it. thanks for the attention. Is there a question? Yes, please.
Could you go back to the proactor slide? So the code of the proactor. Mm-hmm.
So which one? Where we did the?
The one that does the queuing in the U-ring.
This one?
No, no. Which does the queuing actually?
The queuing, the add new read submissions, I think.
Yeah, okay. No, then I don't have a question. Sorry. That's Thank you.
Yes? Are there any?
Have you got any measurements with using IOU ring as opposed to without IOU ring? What kind of latency do you think, performance?
I haven't digged into isolating the performance, but I didn't notice anything other than in a real world system. If you press, it's always the point, if you press in a micro benchmark, you observe something different. You observe a system with a hot cache. But if you do timing measurements, you need to look at the real system, and I have seen it's quite consistent. I have seen on the laptop similar numbers for fetches of that size. So I don't see any noticeable overhead of the IOU ring.
I mean, if you're not using IOU ring, what kind of performance are you going to get? If you're just using plain ordinary?
It doesn't make that much of a difference. It would if we are pressing the boundaries. If we add real compute to it, we need to get away from the IO fast, and we can't afford a wait delay or putting some cores to sleep or put some workers to sleep, and that's the point. The point is here not so much the high performance, like reading little stuff and sending it out in the web. It's more that it makes IO schedulable. The IOU ring. That's the point for the video use case here.
Which of the overheads does IOU ring actually avoid? If I understood the example correctly, the moment when IOU ring finishes reading, we still have the context switch, for example.
No. Because it arrives in user space. Let's dig into it a little bit. You have the overhead to call the kernel when you submit a queue full. Yes. You fill the queue, you do that in user space. It's mapped through both the kernel and the user space, see the same basic memory address. We have a virtual memory system. So that doesn't create an overhead. Then you have to trigger the kernel. I have made the queue full, please process it. There you have for one time this one microsecond of overhead. And then you had no further overhead. The completions are put into the queue, and the internal machinery cares for the synchronization, and you wake up. If you got to sleep, you have the sleep overhead, of course. But if you're writing a server, an internet server with high performance stuff, you won't go to sleep. You will produce more events, and then you are very, really highly efficient. You can get into the millions.
Okay, so my user space thread is woken up with the data there already. Then I don't have the context switch overhead, but
nothing. Yes.
Okay.
You can even go further. For one, there's an API that you can make the kernel pull the queue, so you can even avoid the last kernel call. If you're doing so much I/O that you always feed into the ring, then you can make the kernel pull. So you don't have even a single kernel call. And on the other side, you can go with some special cases. You can go into the realm of no copy I/O or zero copy I/O. Let me explain. It works only with raw buffers. You need to register the buffers with the kernel, and you need raw buffers, also not buffered reads, but raw buffers of the right side. But then you have those fixed buffers, they are already memory mapped. The user space sees them, the kernel sees them. And then you instruct an I/O operation, a DMA happens, the periphery gets in, pours the data into the buffer, and now the kernel sees the same location in the frame cache, and the user space sees the same location. So you can really get it at the zero overhead here, in the extreme case.
Can I also use IOURing to chain operations in the kernel? Like, for example, in the video player, read an H.264 file, then pass it in the kernel to a hardware decoder, and then get woken up with the decoded image?
Absolutely, this is a huge topic. So we basically can get back the channel programs of the mainframes here. You know, in the 60s, we had already channel programs running in the periphery, and we get to something else. Just this year, the kernel guys merged the support for Berkeley package filter in the UI. During. We have already a feature that we can chain, that we can have dependency between actions in the kernel, and we have now the new feature of Berkeley package filter so that we can really write programs, the IOURing. It's just some months old. I think we need to wrap it. We can go outside. You can ask me or address me if you have further questions. Thanks very much.